I see a donut, white. And so we will proceed. This is a workshop, so it's an information item.
All right. Good day, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Nice to see you here today, and public also. This is item 10, a workshop on the development of the Elk River Sediment TMDL. That's the sediment total maximum daily load. My name is Adona White. I'm with the Basin Planning Unit of the North Coast Regional Board. Today, I will be discussing the TMDL development, including aspects of the draft staff report, which is available online, as well as an Elk River water body delineation that staff are proposing, and restoration summit that was recently held, as well as next steps. This is the Elk River watershed. It drains to Humboldt Bay, approximately across from the inlet to the Pacific Ocean. It's comprised, is there a laser pointer? It's comprised of two main forks, the North Fork and the South Fork in the upper watershed, the main stem along the valley, and then Martin Slough comes in from the east, draining the backside of Eureka. According to mapping from by the California Geologic Survey and other, Elk River is comprised primarily of weak geologic formations. This beige color that dominates the North Fork and South Fork there is the Wildcat, and then in the main stem, the tan is the Hooked-In Formation, and about three-quarters of the watershed are comprised of either the Wildcat or the Hooked-In, which are prone to landsliding and high erosion rates, producing fine sediment, either silt or sand size classes, and fine sediment dominates the Elk River system. This figure represents hill slope gradients based on a LIDAR data set that we collected. Thank you, Holly. We have a high-resolution topographic data set of the watershed, and based on those data, approximately half of the watershed is made of slopes of greater than 35%. The color coding here, the red, the dark red and brown, represent slopes of over 50%. So generally, over half the watershed's comprised of slopes of greater than 35%. 35% is often a regulatory trigger for using extra caution or avoidance. So it's a steep watershed, especially the upper watershed. Then Elk River flows through the valley down to Humboldt Bay. And land use in the North Forks and South Forks are dominated by industrial timber, with 83% of the North and South Forks owned by Green Diamond here in this McLeod Creek subwatershed, and the remainder of this dark green is Humboldt Redwood Company. Additionally, 14% of the North Forks and South Forks is managed by BLM and the Headwaters Forest Reserve, shown by the green hatches. And the remaining 3% of that upper watershed is made comprised of residential and ag uses. Now, the lower Elk watershed along the main stem is dominated by ag zoning and uses, shown by this green color. And on the west, generally those ag uses are dairies and dryland grazing. On the western portion of the watershed here, which is the Humboldt Hill area, and also the Martin Slough area, tend to be in residential and urban development. And the Humboldt County General Plan and General Plan update identify those as focal points for growth over the next 20-year period. Now, I'd like to talk briefly about a proposed water body delineation. As under the 303D list, generally strategies involve a water body and pollutant pair. And in this case, it's been Elk River and sediment. It's the water body and the pollutant. Staff are proposing, given those differences in land use and some other factors I'll mention, we're proposing three separate water bodies be delineated in Elk River. And the first being, I'll describe as Upper Elk River, which is made up of North Fork, South Fork, and the upper extent of the main stem. And these areas include the dominant, the industrial timberlands, which have been documented as the dominant sediment source areas in the watershed, as well as the BLM lands. And it includes the reaches, this kind of middle part of the watershed that around the confluence that we've referred to over the years as the nuisance reach, where there's nuisance flooding conditions, there's impaired water supplies, and there's the stored in-stream deposits are most severely documented right here. So that's the Upper Elk River water body, as shown here, has been the focus of our regional board efforts over the years due to the sources and the impairments. It's our priority for TMDL development. The technical analyses have focused on that Upper Elk water body, and the implementation plan will reflect the technical analyses and address the in-stream deposits in that Upper Elk water body. The second water body we're proposing is Little South Fork Elk River, right up here in Headwaters Forest. And it's an unmanaged old-growth subbasin. Its sediment loading and in-stream conditions represent natural conditions, and we believe that delisting of that water body is warranted because water quality objectives are achieved and beneficial uses are supported. Now, the third water body we're proposing is Lower Elk. And that includes the Lower Main Stem and Martin Slough, right there. And like I said, it's dominated by ag and rural and urban residential uses. Generally, this area does not rely on the river for domestic supply. They have either springs or wells or community services district hookups. The sediment sources, water quality conditions, beneficial uses, and flooding frequency are not as well documented as in the upper basin, nor do they seem to be quite as affected as a result of waste discharge. So in terms of anticipated programs, we expect that along the agricultural uses, that over the next 5 years, there will be a statewide grazing program developed or region-wide. There's the recent dairy program that could cover those ag uses along the main stem. The urbanizing areas of Martin Slough and Humboldt Hill, we foresee that those will be designated as phase two municipalities sometime in the next 3 years, either by the regional board or the state board. And that those programs would be available for implementation strategies in that lower basin. And for the Lower Elk, we propose to address the 303D listing either by going forth with TMDL development or by getting those implementation programs in place and providing justification to EPA that existing regulatory programs are reasonably expected to result in attainment of water quality standards within a reasonable specified time frame. So, I just propose this for your consideration and recognize that the technical analyses and the TMDL development efforts at this point are focusing on the Upper Elk. So I'm briefly going to describe some relevant history and actions that have taken place in the Upper Elk River that are relevant to our efforts now. This watershed's been managed for timber harvesting for over 100 years. In 86, there was a change of ownership when Pacific Lumber Company was taken over, and with it came a new style of management, and there was a marked increase in the rate and scale of timber harvest operations and road construction. And the effect of that was that large portions of the watershed were in a freshly disturbed condition and thus more vulnerable to erosion. From 93 to 95, the CDF issued 50 different forest practice rule violations on 14 different timber harvest plans on North Fork alone. Many of them constituted basin plan violations, and they were violations because they didn't a failure to implement the minimum sediment control measures. Then following that, from 95 to 98, the watershed experienced higher than normal annual rainfall, and there were unprecedented discharges of sediment, largely from road and non-road related landslides. And when those discharges came down, they filled in that middle reach I described as the nuisance reach, and severely increased the frequency and magnitude of flooding of people's homes and destroyed water supplies. From 97 to 98, there was a series of regional board actions that led to elk being 303D listed for sediment, that sediment source inventories were to be developed, and replacement water supplies were required for North Fork residents. And we also began a time of receiving petitions to address landsliding and the need for monitoring in the watershed. In 99, the Headwaters deal went through, and Pacific Lumber Company signed their HCP and SYP, and the Headwaters Forest Reserve was established. Also, because of the harvest-related watershed impacts, the flooding, and the need for monitoring, CDF imposed a moratorium on new timber harvest plan development, new timber harvest plan approval. And in 2000, following receipt of a petition calling for waste discharge requirements, staff proposed a suite of regulatory actions for consideration by the regional board. And there was a lot of activity around that time with testimony of interested parties and preparations for hearings. And there was a hope that an improved regulatory framework would be developed that acknowledged the cause and effect of harvesting in Elk River. There was also a lot of pushback to anything above and beyond what the HCP required. We were at that time also working with the HCP agencies and Pacific Lumber Company to establish monitoring with common goals, common monitoring programs that could meet their needs as well as ours. And in 2001, after a series of postponements on those proposed actions, the hearings were vacated by the chairman of the regional board. And then there was, again, a series of petitions to the state board and the regional board for essentially lack of action on those proposed actions. And at that time, also, CDF lifted the moratorium on new harvesting, though there were still outstanding concerns about watershed impacts, flooding, and monitoring. And essentially, the regional board was forced to non-concur and file head of agency appeals and essentially try to pursue remedies given the tools we had. And we led a mediation effort amongst the stakeholders as well as formed a science panel to evaluate not only the HCP framework that was kind of guiding the landscape, but also to look at the effect of harvest-related, to look at tools for evaluating harvest-related landslides and peak flows. And it was the basis of those scientific panels' findings that those findings provided the basis for the watershed-wide waste discharge requirements later. And there was a lot of effort by staff to investigate channel restoration options, which identified the need for a feasibility study and a lead nonprofit or public agency to take on that task of leading a channel restoration effort from the in-stream deposits. And in 2004, we received a petition from 64 Elk River residents calling for the cleanup of in-stream deposits. We then went through, we developed waste discharge requirements, issued cleanup orders, and required monitoring and reporting network, And in the regulatory landscape changed when the regional board regained its authority within the THP process to exert our independent authority on protection of water quality and compliance with the basin plan, with SB 390, which sunsetted waivers, and SB 810, which gave the executive officer veto power of THPs, and it basically really changed the environment we were working in. And in 2006, the watershed-wide waste discharge requirements were developed, and then 2008, Humboldt Redwood Company took over the PL lands following their bankruptcy. So there's been a lot of action and dialogue on these topics over the last 15 years. So with that exhaustive history, I will now get into the draft TMDL problem statement chapter, which describes the sediment impairments which contribute to beneficial uses not being supported and our numeric and narrative water quality objectives being exceeded. Sediment deposition has resulted in reduced cross-sectional area and channel conveyance capacity and altered channel and floodplain morphology. Frequent flooding events inundate areas not historically prone to flooding on multiple times a year now. Fisheries habitat is limited due to pool filling, and spawning gravels are smothered by fines, and sediment deposition is ongoing. Elevated suspended sediment concentrations and turbidity limit the ability for fish to feed and grow, which reduces their chances for ocean survival. And water supplies are limited due to lack of adequate intake locations because of the pool filling. High suspended sediment concentrations and durations limit withdrawal windows, damages equipment, and requires much more frequent maintenance. We have one of the useful historic measurements we have is from the upper mainstem Elk River, where just downstream of the confluence, where the USGS gauged stream flow from 1958 to 1967, and that site was reoccupied by Pacific Lumber Company in 98, and HRC continues monitoring there today. And by bankful discharge, by bankful, I mean that the water level at which the channel is completely full and level with the floodplain. And so the comparisons that we've been able to make here are that there's been a 4-foot reduction or a 20% reduction in bank full stage, that's the water depth, a 400 square foot reduction or 35% reduction in cross-sectional area, which is indicated by this filled channel here, and a corresponding reduction in the bank full discharge capacity. So essentially this helps us understand the magnitude of the change as a result of the channel filling. This is a reach of domestic water withdrawals. You can see fine sediment deposited on the bed and it's draped over the banks. It's buried wood. Pools are filled in. And the flooding conditions in Elk River constitute nuisance conditions, and the California Water Code defines nuisance as anything that meets three criteria of interfering with the free use of property, affecting a community or neighborhood, and occurring as a result of discharge of waste. And fields, roadways, structures, septics now become inundated on a regular basis. The impacts to the flooded neighborhoods are pretty serious in terms of health and safety. People are unable to leave or get home during the floods. Emergency vehicles are unable to access the area, and people have to move vehicles and raise furniture as floodwaters rise, and then afterwards clean up the mud lines that are deposited. There's other conditions that are exacerbated by the water and sediment routing problems, including a destabilizing of stream banks, shown by these cracks here, and a colonization of the in-stream deposits by vegetation. And these additional effects further choke up the channel, slow down velocities, cause sediment to drop out, and further exacerbate the conveyance problem. Currently, we have a implementation program in Upper Elk, which includes WD waste discharge requirements, cleanup and abatement orders, and monitoring and reporting programs. And they're great for tools for treating existing sources of sediment, controlling new sources of sediment, and tracking changes in the system, but they don't currently address the in-stream deposits. I would just demonstrate that we do have, we've got a good in-stream monitoring network established with HRC, Green Diamond, and Salmon Forever all having monitoring stream flow, suspended sediment concentration, and turbidity throughout the watershed using comparable methods. And so, with that, I'll move into the source analysis for the Upper Elk, which is documented in the draft chapter three of the staff report. There's also on the back table, there's an information sheet which kind of summarizes the 100-page source analysis in two pages. So the source analysis for the Upper Elk quantifies the timing and magnitude of it quantifies the timing and magnitude of past sediment loading associated with both natural and management-related hill slope sediment sources. And by sediment loading, I mean a volume of sediment per unit area per year delivered to the stream. And specifically, the data were evaluated in terms of cubic yards per square mile per year. And the source analysis is data rich because we have been requiring sediment source inventories for a number of years. So it's benefited from those efforts. And we were able to develop sub-basin scale data and relied on sub-basin scale data where available. And if those site-specific data weren't available, loadings were developed based on field surveys in steady subbasins, and generally in Upper Elk River, and in one case in Upper Freshwater Creek. And the time periods analyzed correspond to aerial photo set pairs, which are used to identify certain erosion sources, such as landslides. And evaluation of the time period since 2004 was precluded in the current draft because we didn't have landslide inventory updates. We just received an update from HRC this week, and we'll be analyzing those data along with other recent reports to quantify the 2004 to 2010 time period, as well as compare the hill slope estimates with the in-stream measured estimates at that monitoring network I showed on that slide. The source analysis does not evaluate channel routing or remobilization of in-stream deposits. The source analysis was informed by sediment data collection and mapping efforts from a wide spread of professionals associated with agencies, timber companies, private consultants and research institutions. Previous studies indicated that timber harvest and skid trail and road construction were capable of causing headward erosion of watercourses, kind of like gullies unzipping upslope at the very top of the drainage network. And as part of the source analysis effort, staff developed a watercourse network, which was based on the LIDAR topography as well as on field surveys. And we developed a natural and a managed drainage network reflecting those surveys. And the resulting drainage density, that is stream miles per square mile that's associated with the managed network, is 3 times higher than that of the natural network. So the management has resulted in more watercourses higher up the slope, is essentially the findings. So a key component of the source analysis is to quantify the amount of sediment from sources that occur naturally. And the natural sources we evaluated in this effort are shown here, including soil creep, bank erosion, small stream bank landslides, which generally are landslides but too small to identify on aerial photos, shallow hill slope landslides, and deep-seated landslides. A variety of analytical approaches were used to estimate natural sediment loads, including literature values, field surveys in a reference area in Headwaters Forest, aerial photographs, GIS mapping, and land use history. And the methods, results, and uncertainty associated with the estimates are described in detail in the draft Chapter 3 of the staff report. And the end result of the analysis of natural sediment sources indicate a total natural loading of 68 cubic yards per square mile per year, with the primary natural sources being associated with bank erosion, small stream bank landslides, and shallow hill slope landslides. When anthropogenic factors affect an erosion category, we assign that amount to management-related. We took care to ensure that we didn't double count amongst management-related source categories or between natural and management sources. And the management-related sediment source categories that we evaluated include the lowered or channel incision, that is the volume of sediment eroded from that headward migration of the watercourses, management-related soil creep, which delivers to that expanded drainage network, management-related bank erosion and open slope landslides, and generally open slope landslides are non-road-related landslides, and management-related are above and beyond natural. Road-related landslides, management-related streamside landslides, management-related discharge sites, which are generally like stream crossings and some of the often referred to as legacy sites, sites that are being treated under the cleanup and abatement orders, is the management-related discharge sites. Post-treatment discharge sites are the adjustment resulting from the excavation of the treated sites. Skid trails, road surface erosion, and harvest surface erosion. And again, the analytical techniques used in the management-related source analysis include field surveys, GIS mapping, aerial photo and field mapping, erosion monitoring conducted in Elk River, and erosion models. So, the results of the management source analysis are shown in this figure, which I will explain. Each bar represents a management-related, each bar represents the management-related sediment loading associated with the analysis time periods. And the bars correspond to the left axis, which is sediment loading, and they're comprised of the different sediment sources, the different management-related sediment sources. The line corresponds to a percent of natural loading and corresponds to the right axis. The green on the bottom is natural loading. Management-related loading generally was high in the 1950s following the introduction of tractors to the landscape, followed by a period of lower erosion in the 1975 to 87 time period when generally the timber harvesting and road construction slowed and landslide triggering storms didn't seem to occur. The 88 to 97 time period represents the highest loading of all time periods analyzed, with the largest sources being associated with streamside landslides, open slope landslides, road-related landslides, management discharge sites, and road surface erosion. Since then, sediment loading has decreased from that all-time high, and upon the updates that I mentioned, we'll be analyzing the 2004 and 2010 time period will be added to this figure. And I anticipate the analysis will indicate a continued downward trend, though sediment loading is still significantly elevated over natural loading. And while there's uncertainty associated with each one of these estimates that are described in the document, the same analysis was conducted systematically over time and space, and thus it offers a relative comparison and a relative measure. And last on this source analysis topic, Pacific Lumber Company had conducted a watershed analysis, and they developed a sediment budget for the 1988 to 2000 time period. And I did a comparison just to help people understand some of the differences between the two analyses, with the PL watershed analysis shown on the right and our TMDL source analysis on the left. Under natural, first, the total loading is very similar, the difference being the percent over natural. And one of the major differences is on the streamside landslides. They attributed all non-road-related streamside landslides to natural sources, and bank erosion was split 50-50 between natural and management, and we relied on field surveys for those estimates. And also, HRC is about to undertake a watershed analysis revisit in which they'll reevaluate the sediments budget, and we're hopeful that some of our analyses can help benefit that process, as well as we can learn about the recent time period from those updates. In terms of next steps for the Upper Elk TMDL development, we'll update the draft staff report chapters 1 through 3. And we will complete the remaining pieces of the technical TMDL, including targets, linkage, load allocations, and margin of safety, and monitoring and reevaluation. We have an implementation framework that we provided as our CEQA scoping, and we'll refine and update that based on the technical analyses and recent developments. We'll bring it back to the Regional Water Board for a workshop and consideration, and then pursue a basin plan amendment. Watershed recovery, in Elk River likely needs to include three components. The first being a strategy to bring the sediment loads in line with the watershed's assimilative capacity. That is, how much loading the system can handle while still achieving water quality objectives, beneficial use protection, and prevention of nuisance. Essentially, it's a strategy for the upper watershed to produce clean water. And achievement of the TMDL load is The TMDL load allocations will need to include prevention of new sediment sources and minimization of existing sources, and we anticipate an aggressive load reduction program will be necessary, especially since some of the existing sources are likely going to be difficult to control, for example, bank erosion and streamside landslides. The WDRs, CAOs, and monitoring and reporting programs will need to be revised to reflect the technical analyses, achieve the load allocations, and track progress on that first component. And it will be difficult to achieve the maximum benefit of reduced sediment loads without also addressing the stored sediment in the channel, and especially in that middle reach, upstream and downstream of the confluence of North Fork and South Fork. And considering the sediment characteristics and the inability of the current channel to contain regular high flows, it's unlikely the river will be able to scour itself, to scour the stored deposits in the foreseeable future. And as such, the second component to a watershed recovery in Elk River requires a strategy to identify and implement restoration actions that will hasten recovery of channel capacity and ecosystem function. And there have been a number of ideas put on the table over the years, from dredging to vegetation clearing, and basically to ensure that any of these actions are going to achieve the desired effect and avoid unintended consequences, there needs to be a scientifically based strategy to evaluate the actions in combination with sediment loads from the upper watershed. And such a scientifically based evaluation will also be necessary for permitting. So to that end, and with the input from technical experts in sediment transport and geomorphology, a strategy has been identified which includes construction, calibration, and validation of hydrodynamic and sediment transport models of the river those tools could be used to assess the effects of a range of actions individually, collectively, and under a range of flows, sediment loads, and timeframes, and will lead to confidence that the actions that are will essentially perform as desired and have a high likelihood of success. The approach will take money and some time for data collection, but we believe that such a systems approach is appropriate and necessary given the severity and persistence of the in-stream deposits, especially in the middle reach, and such an approach will lead to a successful cleanup plan. So the third component may include some near-term projects aimed at improved conveyance and sediment load reduction or habitat improvement. But without a more comprehensive strategy in place, as I just described, these projects should be low risk so as to avoid unintended consequences either upstream or downstream of the project. And because they're likely to be experimental, they should be tracked for their performance so that we can learn from them. In an effort to define a process for stakeholder participation and buy-in and to build agreement on a technical approach for developing the cleanup and restoration plan that I described in the bullet two of the last slide, last month we held an Elk River Restoration Summit, and it was a staff-led workshop co-hosted with Redwood Community Action Agency, RCAA, who's a Eureka-based nonprofit that has been working with Proposition 50 grant funding to support sediment monitoring and conduct landowner outreach and assistance in Elk River and Freshwater Creek. And it was via that grant funding that the 2007 Sediment Monitoring Summit was held, and a technical advisory group was formed, and a restoration strategy was developed, which fulfills that second component to watershed recovery. And the restoration strategy builds in stakeholder buy-in. So we had attendance at the summit from landowners from the upper, middle, and lower portions of the watershed, from agency staff who handle permits, technical assistance, and funding, as well as resource professionals and advocacy groups. The presentations there describe the need for the cleanups, a proposed technical approach, and a description of some pilot modeling being done in a short reach around the confluence where we have enough data to support the models currently. The preliminary results of the pilot modeling indicates there's good agreement between the predicted and the observed water surface elevations and suspended sediment concentrations, indicating that these tools will be extremely helpful in evaluating restoration actions. They're likely good tools to move forward with. And there was discussion of options for a watershed or restoration group to be formed. And the presentation materials from the summit are posted on our Elk River website for anyone who's interested in looking at those. Really, the outcomes of that workshop are still forming. There's been a lot of conversations happening, that some of which I've been privy to and many of which I probably haven't been privy to. At the workshop, there was an expressed agreement on the need for restoration, with many landowners describing the need to clean up sediment deposits and also to manage vegetation. Additionally, there was a clear expression by landowners that a watershed group should be landowner-driven, and that different parts of the watershed have different needs, but that some coordination is appropriate. Craig Benson of RCAA, who facilitated the summit, he's funded for the next couple years from the Department of Conservation for watershed coordination in Humboldt Bay and Mad River, and under that he could provide facilitation services in an initial effort to bring landowners to get a landowner-driven watershed group together, if landowners so choose. And as things unfold on this topic, you know, we look forward to relying on a coordinated, collaborative effort where possible to address the cleanups and restoration of the sediment-impaired reaches of Elk, and we'll definitely keep you informed on new developments there. So we anticipate coming back to you with a workshop with the full draft technical TMDL, followed by an action item for your consideration this coming summer and fall. And the analyses that you can expect to see include the updated Chapter 3, including the geographic scope I described with that water body delineation. So we'll come to you with focusing on the Upper Elk water body. Updated analyses of in-stream conditions relative to water quality objectives and beneficial uses, specifically turbidity analyses, suspended sediment load analyses, and analyses of cross-sectional changes. As well, we'll bring the targets chapter, which include in-stream targets for habitat and prevention of nuisance, and hill slope targets based on an analysis of controllable water quality factors affecting each of the management-related sediment source categories. We'll compare in-stream suspended sediment measurements with the hill slope loading estimates from the source analysis, and we'll provide estimate of the sediment loading capacity based on a weight of evidence approach of multiple indicators and the resulting load allocations, and including margin of safety. And without a watershed recovery plan, application of our regulatory and non-regulatory tools may be insufficient to achieve the desired goals. And the tools I refer to include waste discharge requirements, waivers, prohibitions, cleanup and abatement orders, monitoring and reporting programs, progressive enforcement partnerships. The current WDRs, the current watershed-wide WDRs, were developed as a near-term permitting strategy while the TMDL was developed. And unless the permits reflect and implement a watershed recovery plan, they tend to revert to a project-by-project permitting strategy, which is inherently incapable of dealing with cumulative watershed effects. And so revision of the Elk watershed-wide waste discharge requirements is going to be needed to reflect watershed recovery plan, which takes into consideration sediment loading from all management-related sources, as well as the assimilative capacity of the river. And until the in-stream deposits are cleaned up, the assimilative capacity is severely compromised. When we bring the TMDL package to you, the technical TMDL package at another workshop, and then for your consideration, staff believe that you have the discretion at that point to direct staff to incorporate those results into revision of the permits, even before a basin plan amendment process is complete, because that basin plan amendment process will take some time. And in the coming months, the Southern Timber Unit will likely be bringing you an update on the status of the current waste discharge requirements and cleanup and abatement orders. And we do maintain the Elk River TMDL website, posting relevant materials and public review drafts of the staff report. Also, we maintain a LIRIS email mailing list to help inform people of updates and workshops. And I encourage people to sign up for that mailing list such that we can effectively have a public participation in this TMDL development process. And with that, I will end my presentation. Thank you for your attention, and I would be happy to take some questions, and then we'll have a period of public comment on the item, and then time for board discussion. So.
Sounds like you got it all worked out.
That was what I was anticipating.
By the way, I would remind people, if you want to speak, please fill out a speaker card. I only have two of them. Donna, thank you. Nice to get an update. I'm sorry I didn't. Board member questions, Mr. Corbett.
One is, do you have the method that you've calculated the margin of safety? And if you want to give a considered answer, I certainly could get it. But before we pass, I do want to look at that and would have it red flagged based upon the 303D process that that's unusually important. I did want to thank you for your work. I want to go. Gets a little confusing between TMDL and the permit, but the permit had three big issues: timber harvest, which got confined primarily to the harvest rate, and a little bit into identifying erosion control plan priorities. We had roads and we had restoration, and I thought from a watershed standpoint, we gave a short shrift to roads, and so I'm really glad, and that'd be my biggest thing, is that we recognize the difference between a road plan and erosion control plan. And it fills the gap of the original WDR. It also gets a better regulatory alignment and interface, both now and in the future, I think, with the CAL FIRE and the forest practice rules. It's a watershed concept. It gets some way to rationally, in an affordable way, look at legacy roads. And lastly, it's consistent with the independent science panel, who under questioning did indicate concerns with roads that we were unable to factor into the permit. Restoration, it's critical. We're never going to solve this until we can get to restoration. And it's critical the people in the watershed are involved, because I can tell you, it's, if there's any opposition, everyone's going to be able to kill a permit. Industry can kill it. The residents can kill it. So we've got to have some kind of organic agreement if you're going to get restoration permits through just a terribly difficult situation. So I think that's a good way to handle it, and great job.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Hepp?
Thanks, Donna. You know, I guess just building off of what John was saying, just visualizing toward restoration, we know the assimilative capacity is greatly compromised, and the only way you're going to fix that is by really reversing that, however, through vegetation or sediment removal. Assuming that's, or maybe optimistically, hopefully, that's an inevitable step, is it premature to start talking with other agencies, or have you done that? Fish and Game, Coastal Commission, some of the other players that would have to be involved if an action like that's taken. Has there been any communication between them so far? And maybe do they know all the hard work that you've been doing and are probably acutely interested in it?
Many of those agencies were in attendance at the Restoration Summit, and that was certainly our hope. We
sure.
wanted them there so that, and we've talked to them over the years about what permits would they require, what sort of technical analyses would they require, is it even a possibility to have a cleanup and restoration program? Yes, but clearly, we're in a little bit of a tricky situation in that they want to know what the plan is before they can evaluate implementation and permitting. And to have a plan, that takes an effort to develop that plan. But certainly they're included. And they see what I believe they were generally supportive of pursuing some sort of restoration.
It seemed, from the previous workshops, I don't think I've missed one yet, but the most recent one, that was exceptionally well attended by a breadth of agency folks, and so that was encouraging to see that there, and I just didn't know if they were there out of curiosity or you'd started, engaging them in conversation, but that's great. And then, secondly, I'm particularly interested in the 2003 to 2010 component of the source analysis. When's that going to hit the streets?
Prior to our next workshop.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Post that.
Kind of a core presentation element.
That's once this workshop is over, I will dive directly into that effort.
Okay. Thanks.
And, just one thing I would say about the following up on the Restoration Summit, we did take a field trip to South Fork Elk at the BLM parking lot there. And the parking lot was full of people. There was two slots left for our vans, and it was full of people going to see coho spawning. And it was nice to, because there's so much talk about recovery for, from the flooding, from a people standpoint, but really the fish they have the same need.
Well,
so it was very telling at the Restoration Summit that there were so many people to see coho.
And building on that, I've been out there several times with my family, and I've seen several people in this room walking out there as well, and I think the word is getting out where there's even new community members that are keying in on that, and so just the awareness of the watershed and the issues that are happening is growing, so it's nice to see that.
So may I ask you, the problem is dirt. It's no great secret, right? And that, the timelines that are laid out here, this has been going on for a long time. A couple of questions down that road.
I hesitate to provide you a number on that. It's a lot of material. There's the stream length that we're talking about being affected is from the top of the depositional reach, likely, around Bridge Creek on North Fork and Tom's Gulch on South Fork as rough estimates. On down, it's unclear how far downstream the deposits persist and should be addressed. It's a lot of material, but that's why we need to, part of the proposed strategy is to do some data collection efforts to really characterize the deposits. How deep are they? What length of channel is affected? And we really think we need some data collection, including longitudinal profiles and cross sections and sediment cores, grain size analyses, to be able to evaluate the transport capacity and the storage.
Thank you.
I think that, you know, the erosion control plans associated with timber harvest plans and the cleanup and abatement orders are really crucial pieces to repair those existing sources on the landscape and keep that sediment from entering the stream. I would say that in the coming months, we will be able to better integrate the THP process with our timber staff and the TMDL analyses. I think the targets chapter with the hill slope targets is really going to help to identify conditions on the landscape that are somewhat performance standards to help bring those together. I think there's room for improvement on the integration of these TMDL analyses and the timber review. Yes. I do would add that, you know, the waste discharge requirements and their assessment of harvest-related landslides is an incredibly important piece of early implementation. I mean, it's been the primary sediment source in this watershed has been road-related landslides and open slope landslides, harvest-related slides. And so, you know, there's the waste discharge requirements were designed to control harvest-related landsliding by limiting the overall disturbance level. And there's been a closer look at hill slopes via the Tier 2 component. And road-related landsliding, I mean, the Humble Redwood Company and Green Diamond and BLM, they all have programs to improve the active roads via stormproofing, better drain them, work on surfacing. So that's helping the road-related landsliding. There's a lot going on in the watershed, but there's, I believe, a need for better integration. And, you know, in terms of early implementation, I would see that. I mean, there's the in-stream deposits, which really that's going to take concerted effort. In terms of the first component I mentioned of watershed recovery, getting clean water to come down the watershed, that's, you know, that's a big task in and of itself. And yeah. I think both of those first two components are going to be pretty important and pretty challenging in some ways. I mean, it's a soft watershed with a lot of, it's the hydrology in this watershed is pretty unique, I think, given some of the soft geology, the subsurface flows and effects of management on peak flows at different scales, I think is pretty relevant. And how some of the analyses translate into early implementation or, you know, long-term implementation, I'd say stay tuned. But I would not assume that, you know, both of those two components are crucial, and they're both going to take a lot of effort.
Identifying a problem and crafting regulation to control that problem. Mm-hmm. And from all accounts so far, those have seemed to be working pretty well. We've got programs in place to control the amount of material coming into Elk River. Or at least we have spent a lot of time and energy in developing those to make it happen. And whether that's the effectiveness of that, mm-hmm. I think we're still checking on mm-hmm. that. But I think optimistically it's working. Now, we need to channel those efforts either in parallel or shift gears a little bit to start working on what's affecting the residents right now. I mean, this is really what's affecting them. They know what the problem is. We know what the problem is. We know where it's coming from. We know how to control it as best we can, mm-hmm. striking a balance between management and natural process. But what's really affecting the residents of that drainage right now is the existing condition that's there right now. So great job dialing it back. Let's figure out how we can fix the channel right now to at least help alleviate some of the flooding. Mm-hmm. That's where I cast my vote for shifting, or not necessarily shifting, but emphasizing an effort to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would offer that those two efforts would be in parallel, because we really need to refine the prevention approach to get the clean water to come down off the hill slopes, because right now sediment loads are still quite high, and definitely pursue the in-stream actions. And that's, as you know, Jeff, there's funding that in-stream restoration effort. It's a little bit challenging because we're not at implementation yet, but there's, as I said, following on the summit, there's been a lot of conversations.
They're inextricably linked, and you need one to have the other one happen. And
so, we're just really trying to sort through to come up with some options to get that effort rolling.
That's kind of my hinting at when I was asking for the 03 to 2010 rates. So.
Yeah. I have one follow-up to John's questions, if that's all right. Okay, well, sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks. No problem.
I'm going to move on and do some public comment. I have a couple speaker cards here. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Likewise.
First speaker card I have is for Andy Westfall.
My name is Andy Westfall. I'm a landowner in Elk River. Mr. Chairman, members of the board and staff, I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. My issue is with the boundary line between the upper and the lower Elk as proposed. I don't understand the criteria being used for the delineation of the upper Elk and the lower Elk. Logic would suggest grouping likes with likes. Yet the proposed description for the upper Elk mixes industrial timber with a very small segment of residential, ag land, and some non-industrial timber. Our property, 22 acres of forest land and 56 acres of grazing land, is included in this segment. As you know, the Elk has been listed as impaired for sediment. The upper reaches of the watershed have been identified as the sources of this sediment. The lower reaches, including the small area I've described, are the receivers of this sediment. In designing regulations to reduce sediment, does it not make more sense to separate the areas that produce the sediment from the areas that receive it? Thank you.
Speaker I have is Mr. Lane Russ. Good afternoon, board and chairman. My name is Lane Russ. I'm an Elk River resident, also currently the chairman of our Elk River's landowners group. Our group is primarily the ag and non-industrial timber landowners from kind of the confluence or just where Andy's at on down to the fish and game property. And we kind of came into being when this TMDL was initially developed. We found the initial drafts really lacking and also very generalized in the descriptions of the lower elk in particular. And we've been working with staff, providing comments back to them as well as having multiple meetings with them. And we appreciate their responsiveness in taking our concerns and addressing them. The other thing I wanted to say is that our group currently is working with NRCS in developing some sort of information on the lower elk. There's been very little work done down there. We just recently completed a tour with NRCS from the fish and game property up through the covered bridges, taking pictures and documenting some of the conditions down there. And we're going to be looking to focus on what projects can be done to alleviate some of the flooding that's taking place. And we'll look forward to working with other groups throughout the land, throughout the watershed if there's other projects come available. So that's all I had.
Hey, Wayne, can I ask you,
Sure.
You maybe expound on what type of projects you're thinking about doing in the Middle Reach to alleviate flooding?
I think when most people or most of the long-term landowners that have been in that valley for some time can she only comment on is the amount of choked vegetation that's clogging that lower channel, especially from the fish and game property on up. In some of the middle reaches of the channel years ago, CCC did some vegetation removal. So there was actually some work done, and some of it was in fact done on our property. But from the covered bridges on down, the channel is completely choked with log jams and caved in trees that are hanging over and creating conditions where it's not allowing the velocity of that river to obtain its potential. And so we're looking primarily on those issues initially, or projects initially.
How many river runs are you talking approximately?
Oh, boy, I'd say 5 to 6, right in there, somewhere in there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. The next card I have is for Mr. Daniel Meyer.
Good afternoon, Daniel Myers for the Mendocino or the Redwood chapter of the Sierra Club. I just had one point on the boundaries where it's broken into three pieces. A very small piece that's been set aside is to be delisted. I'm a little concerned about what happens to it should it subsequently need to be incorporated into this plan after it's been delisted. I think every watershed TMDL will have lands on it that don't really require remediation. It's just that you do the entire watershed and you have basically one set of plan. And this may be something that EPA asked for, but it seems to me that this small piece, unless it is actually protected in perpetuity by some group or something, I don't think it should be cut out of this TMDL. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Mr. Gary Ryerson next.
Mr. Chairman, board members, Gary Ryerson with Green Diamond Resource Company. Adona gave a great history in the background in the Elk River, and also we've worked with Adona a lot in the Elk River, starting with and including the 2006 drainage wide WDR that we have. We have about 1,800, 1,900 acres, about 3 square miles in the South Fork of Elk. We developed that drainage-specific WDR at the time with water quality and staff, knowing that the TMDL was being prepared. So some of the measures that are built into that drainage-wide WDR include anticipation of the development of this TMDL. That includes special mitigation measures well above and beyond the current forest practice rules, and also a comprehensive road analysis and road upgrade program. We also undertake special harvesting methods in that drainage, as we do in many of the other drainages when it comes to ground-based harvesting. Also part of the 2006 drainage-specific WDR was a comprehensive monitoring program. In 2007, we received an approval with our Federal Aquatic Habitat Conservation Plan, which also, of course, includes a very comprehensive approach to planning and implementation. One of the centerpieces of that is a comprehensive road analysis and road upgrading program targeted specifically at with an accelerated front-end 15-year reduction of sediment from road-related sources. And, of course, the Elk River drainage is part of that process. 2008, we received the consistency agreement from the Department of Fish and Game, recognizing the benefits of our aquatic habitat conservation plan for the endangered or for the listed threatened coho salmon that also resides in that drainage. We actually included in that 2008 agreement with Fish and Game some additional measures that are specific to the unique geologies that are found in the Elk River and some of the surrounding drainages with those very soft uplifted marine terrace soils that we deal with, or parent materials. Looking forward, we're in the process now of developing a property-wide WDR that will incorporate the measures that are currently in the Elk River WDR. And also, if you look at the figure 2 in the one pager on the back, there's a great trend line that's showing a downward trend for sediment, and we hope that's about 11 years of additional data that could be added to that, and hopefully we'll see that trend line continue downward in achieving some of the goals. So appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, hello, board. I'm the human element from the upper watershed area known as the nuisance reach, or as at the last summit, we simply got reduced to the nuisance people. And I guess in some ways we are, but it's quite painful to us. Some of you, there's only one of you I haven't met before, and I look forward to meeting you. And so a special hello to Heidi, Bill, and David, and Jeff, and John. And I'll read an email to you that I sent to Kat and Matt recently. It says, "Good morning, Kat and Matt. I'm still very worried about the rate and scale of logging in the Elk River watershed. We're the residents suffering from all the harm, past and present, that logging has brought upon our valley, whether accounted for or not, in all the paper formulas. We need relief now, not after the TMDL is done. This is especially evident with all the ill-gotten gain from the Tier 2 logging. It was an abuse of the public process and a completely twisted interpretation of the so-called zero sediment logging that Maxam PL was able to get so much extra logging. Our watershed cannot stand the Tier 1 logging levels, let alone the horrendous acreage that's been added on with Tier 2. The most knowledgeable people who understand how the Elk River watershed in our nuisance reach reacts are the longtime residents who have observed and lived with the river for decades. Our understanding comes from experience. It's not based on the science done in other areas, as most of the Board of Forestry rules are. Your water quality analysis, though taken from our watershed, does not reflect the whole truth. Science, after the fact, never does. Please investigate our firsthand eyewitness knowledge and understanding of our watershed. Residents like Ralph Krause and I and Norm Pasteris, who have all been there 40 plus years, closer to 50 or 60, and yes, Jesse Noel, have been the only voices whose projected truths have been verified by the reality we live now. We all acknowledge that any and all logging creates sediment, Tier 2 logging creates a lot of sediment that is not accounted for except by those of us living below. To declare only the sediment from landslides as significant is wholly inadequate and just plain untrue. The landslides of the 1990s created the problems, but all logging is making them worse. Flooding due to decreased channel capacity has increased significantly in the last 10 years. We've seen nearly a foot of added sediment on the banks, and our cross-sections verify that. HRC's logging, and however good it is not making the situation better for the residents living directly below. Not with 400 to 500 acres being logged. Please direct your EO to either re-examine and understand how much sediment is coming from that Tier 2 logging. But really, within your grasp, you have the power to revoke the MRP and Tier 2 logging. It is devastating to us. It is especially visible on the South Fork. It looks like we did in 1990. We need a margin of safety in our favor. Sediment is continuing to settle out on our land, and it all comes from upstream. We should not have our lives and livelihood, property and access increasingly threatened by the upstream neighbors' high level of logging. They get to profit while we get the harm. Harm that should have been stopped 15 years ago when I first addressed this situation. Nuisance flooding is more than just a nuisance, it's devastating to us. We flood on and over the road in a 2-inch rainstorm. A 4-inch rainstorm is very scary to all of us living there. I have some added thoughts, which are, everybody talks about that in-stream sediment. In my reach of the river, I can tell you it's 5 to 6 feet all around my farm, all the way down to my red house. I know what the river looked like. I have marks that I can go by. And we see it every year bury our hoses. They bury our fences even further. We see no relief. We see much flashier floods. And it's very disconcerting. CDF does not deal with cumulative effects, especially off-site cumulative effects. We've tried to get their attention onto that fact, and we are unable to do it. And you as a board can't do anything about what they can do, but you can do something about Tier 2 logging. And when we talk about our losses, they're quite significant. On my farm, for me, it's a minimum of $30,000 a year. And that's considering just 2 boxes per tree, which is very minimal, and only 60 cents a pound for apples, which is about minimal. And we have nowhere to turn but you. You have done a lot of work. If there is any way that we can help you do more and better work, please engage us. We're ready. I've had to volunteer thousands of hours with Salmon Forever, doing the cross-sections, numbering the bottles and the filters, and running the samples and washing the bottles and doing it all over again. That is a lot to ask for the person that is destroyed. My whole farm is absolutely unproductive at this point, and I only see it getting worse. I see no way for it to become productive. We do have a lot of interest. And we, in recovery, we need CDF at the table. They did not even attend the summit. He has a scheduling problem. We've been there for 15 years, and they've known about it for 15 years. And it wasn't the first time Bill wasn't there because he had a scheduling problem. I do have to compliment your EO, Kat Coleman. She has always given us a straight, yes, I can be there, no, I can't. I can be there this date, I can see you when here. She's been very straightforward. She's been very cooperative. And I thank you for that. And I hope you, I have pictures here. I hope you invite questions. We are the eyes. We've been there. We see it. And we are the humans that are being flooded. We don't wish ill will on anybody, but somehow we're getting all the ills from this logging. And we are willing to work not only with our downstream neighbor, but our upstream neighbor and any and every agency or person that is out there. I've had inquiries about recovery. I'd like to engage the whole watershed. I think it's all important. I think the needs of my downstream neighbor are not to be overregulated when they care about how they manage their land and reaching a way where you don't have to put out efforts onto their land and that they get to do something without overreaching regulation is incredibly important. So that, and one thing I would like to say to David, you said that it was a long period of time that this deposition came. No, it was not. It was between approximately 88 and 98. That deposition that is now in our reach was mainly done. And those are all the slides, and they all happened. So everybody focuses on those slides. Well, most of those slides, you know, we'd healed from the 40s and 50s logging. And then they came along and peeled it a whole bunch bare, and oh my gosh, then we had rain. What do you think's going to happen? You're going to get a bunch of slides. Most things are going to slide. Now, it is not our biggest source. It's all roads. It's the massive amount of logging. Massive. We've known 75 to 150 acres of logging, and now we have 400. It's too much for our watershed to take in the best of conditions, let alone the worst of conditions. So we'd like to work with that, but we'd like the truth addressed, too. So, thank you.
First, I'd like to go back to Mr. Corbett's question and point about a margin of safety. It is my intention that, and for each of the sediment source categories, I've done my best to identify and where possible to quantify uncertainty associated with the source estimate. I believe that we may have an explicit margin of safety on this particular TMDL. Many of them are implicit. We'll see how it comes out with the analyses, but certainly we will have a margin of safety. And absolutely, road management plans are crucial and need to be part of the implementation package. And currently there are roads management plans via the habitat conservation plans, but we likely need to evaluate them and build them into the implementation program. So,
if you look at the Dickey Act, 1949 to 1969, before the Porter-Cologne Act, it really was a load allocation act, and by most accounts was not effective at solving the problems. Similarly, the same way with the old Federal Water Pollution Control Act. And 303D said when everything else fails, then go to load allocation. But what we have is a lot of a very detailed record that's very hard to do. It's very challenging. And so that suggests having very carefully considered the margin error. Now I'll go a little bit to the folding chairs in the audience. I've seen agencies abuse that to predetermine the condition, and so I want a rational basis for it too, because I don't want to be unfair with it. But there's a lot of reason to believe that's warranted given the best efforts of California to apply that system really for 20 years and we're unable to reach success. And we got a lot more science now, things are a lot better. Same thing with the feds, and it just is a wake-up call to me. If we take something that's been real hard to make work in the water quality arena, we need to have an adequate level of prudence in approaching it.
And I would say that, you know, taking a prevention approach with each of the sediment source categories is certainly the perspective we're pursuing. So hopefully that's consistent with your concerns, John.
And then I want to say the other side of that is to be fair to the discharger, and I've been on both sides of the aisle on adequate margins of safety, so I appreciate that it's needed and appreciate it's got to be fair.
You know, I think I meant to mention Andy Westfall's concern about the lower and middle reaches with the water body delineation because we have talked about it, and I recognize his concerns. I would add that I think there's value in maintaining a connection between the cause and the effect, the source areas and the impaired reaches, and the Upper Elk water body, as I presented, maintains that connection. And to Daniel Meyer's concern about Little South Fork Elk River reference watershed potentially being delisted, that is a part of the Headwaters Forest Reserve, which should be protected into perpetuity. And appreciate Lane's and Gary's comments, and in terms of Christy's comments, I think, you know, I hear a lot about concerns over the Tier 2 logging, and was just recently reminded that in South Fork, in fact, there is not a cap on the overall disturbance, the overall acreage limitation in South Fork Elk, because there was no peak flow compliance point identified, so there was no peak flow limit, and the Tier 2 allows harvesting from the landslide cap up to the peak flow limit, and there isn't a peak flow limit in South Fork, so it's just for your further understanding about the points she was making. And otherwise, I appreciate people's willingness to help and participate. It's been, we've had a lot of public participation lately, and it's been really wonderful. So I look forward to that continuing.
One question back, Colin. When you were given explanation for the delineation for Andy's property, and you talked about that, will he get lumped into a different regulation category based on that designation? Is it just a physical boundary that doesn't really have any bearing on it? I mean, in terms of your criteria for and your rationale for defining that area, it's more from a physical layout rather than from, and will that in turn manifest itself into different regulatory jurisdiction or?
Yeah, he's right about here. And yeah, the boundary was.
I suppose Christy falls up into that same.
And she has timber and others. Krause has timber. There's other non-industrial timberlands up in this area. It was based on, you know, hydrology essentially, as well as where those areas picking up these parcels in the 100-year floodplain and this stretch of river that relies on the river for domestic supply. It's about Elk River Courts is where I propose the boundary. In terms of your question about regulation, you know, in terms of the grazing program topic, I suggested relying on a statewide grazing program development. We're focusing on sediment in this watershed and not on other pollutants with the TMDL development. So I don't foresee that the TMDL itself would have additional regulations for this area versus down there. In terms of our non-industrial timberlands, as we presented in our implementation framework at our CEQA scoping meeting in 2008, which is on our ELK website, we said that we foresee for non-industrial timberlands, we could rely on our general waste discharge requirements or our categorical waiver, as we do today, though the analyses may indicate some additional conditions, such as take a look at our landslide hazard map and respond to, you know, accordingly, for example. So I don't foresee like any special permitting needs necessarily. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, some of this stuff is just so complex, it's very hard to, but I want to say there is a relationship between the margin error and best management approaches and a road plan, and best management practices and a road plan is the general regulatory approach that's been used to try and overcome the very problem I talked about. So I also want to say that there are relationships there. It's not just a simple matter, as I'm sure you're aware of. I mean, wallowed in this for some period of time.
Any other comments, questions? Okay, Donna, I think we'll see you. It sounds like again maybe in the fall.
Summer, fall.
Start to talk about how we can go forward on this.
Yes.
Some pieces and parts.
Thank you.
I appreciate you working in this watershed. Again, I'm sorry I missed that workshop.
Yep.
You had our Mr. Hale there, which was to good effect. So
excellent.
I look forward to hearing about this in the future.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Fantastic. We're going to take a 5-minute break. We'll be right back, and we'll take on dairies very quickly, and then we'll take on contagion pill. So we'll be back in 5 minutes.